Impact. According to Webster, one meaning of the word impact is to force tightly together. Well, there was togetherness as the IEEE convention delegates crowded the Hilton Ballroom for a discussion on system technologies in politics and economics. But another meaning of the word impact, namely collision or conflict, was soon apparent as each individual speaker discussed the impact of technology on his particular world of education, healthcare, transportation, telecommunications, or urban development. Particularly provocative were the remarks of Dr. Barber of the Institute for Politics and Planning.
Education is the largest U.S. industry, surpassing even the Defense Department budget. It is also an obsolete and inefficient monopoly. We literally know far less about the raising of children than we do about the raising of cows, chickens, and pigs. This is not really surprising. For the last 50 years, we've spent far more money learning how to raise chickens and pigs than we've spent to learn how to raise and educate children. The raising of cows is profitable, and we know the cost of failing. But we have not yet recognized as a society the price of failure in raising children. And the results can be seen all around us, contented cows and disturbed children.
Citing as a fact that many graduate from high school without being able to read or write, the professor was critical of the system under which stress in job seeking is placed upon such credentials as diplomas or degrees, when what the employer really needs is the knowledge as to whether an applicant can do the job.
Wouldn't it be revolutionary if schools, industry, and government began to test a man or woman to determine whether he or she could do a job effectively, rather than asking for useless and irrelevant credentials?
But Professor Barber's remarks were not all negative. On the constructive side, he had this to say.
In the school of the future, we will abolish grades, but we will not abolish standards of achievement. Each child should receive a report of what he has accomplished, and the teacher should write a short human appreciation of the child's development. Then every child can measure his achievements, but we need not force him to compete against his colleagues.
Having strayed perhaps from the assigned topic of the impact of system technology on education, Professor Barber concluded his remarks with an expression of faith in this new medium.
There can be no question that within the decade and probably within 5 years, any school system will be able to teach a child the basic fundamentals more easily through individual machine instruction than by the manual system now being used.
While we ponder Dr. Barber's words, John, tell us about the next speaker and the next impact.
The next impact to be discussed was the impact of technology's advance on the national telecommunications system. And the speaker, Mr. Leland Johnson, now associated with the RAND Corporation, was formerly director of research of the President's Task Force on National Communications Policy. Said Mr. Johnson,
perhaps most spectacular are the examples to be drawn from long-distance transmission technology, particularly communication satellites. In comparison with the earlier open wire circuitry, the employment of microwave and coaxial cable has had a dramatic effect on circuit cost and quality. Today, a good deal of investment in long-distance transmission is going into coaxial cable. An earlier cable, the so-called L1 cable, had a capacity of a couple of thousand voice channels, and it involved an annual cost of about $3 per voice channel. Its successor, the L3, had something like eight times the capacity, 16,000 voice channels, and the circuit cost dropped to about $1.50. Today, we are seeing the installation of the L4, which has over 32,000 voice circuits at something in the neighborhood of 90 cents per voice channel, a drop of more than threefold in comparison with the L1. And in the early and mid-70s, we foresee the installation of the so-called L5, which will have 81,000 voice circuits, a couple of times more than the L4, at a circuit cost of maybe 35 cents. So we see an order of magnitude change in the circuit cost from the L1 to the 5.
Commenting on the extent to which new communication technology will affect the radio spectrum, Mr. Johnson expressed confidence mingled with caution.
A good deal of experimentation is required. But I feel confident that with the many trade-offs that exist in satellite design and in other equipment design, that there can be, with the radio spectrum, an enormous increase in telecommunications capacity involving satellites, involving microwave, involving other applications. going far beyond what we can now visualize. But again, what this will take is a sensible public policy, a sensible management technique with respect to use of the radio spectrum.
Another impact to be discussed was that on urban development.
Before very long, 80% of us are going to live in about 2% of the available land area.
The voice is that of Dr. Manfred Altman, Director of Urban Research at the University of Pennsylvania. Speaking of the overcrowding of our cities and the consequent challenge to the urban researcher, Dr. Altman was sympathetic.
The problem is that he's very severely limited in the kinds of experiments he can perform.
Concerning the variation between the viewpoints of the city planning researcher and the mayor or leading official who employs him, Dr. Altman said,
"His boss wants results in 4 years, obviously so, because he wants to be reelected. He's constantly told to be practical and not to be a visionary."
Part of the problem, according to Dr. Altman, is the failure of people to work together, to interact.
I would suggest to you that what we need to do is to establish a National Academy of Human Values. This organization should come to grips with problems such as these. Why are our cities still growing in spite of the fact that all the old justifications, such as easy defense, a ready bartering place, available public transportation, really don't apply anymore? And yet cities keep growing all the time. This academy ought to address itself to questions such as these. Can one analyze cities from the point of view of a minimum energy system, a maximum communications and information system, a cultural system? What are the thermodynamic analogs to a city? Does entropy have a meaning when you talk about a city? The cost of relocation of ghetto residents versus inevitable chaos? Based on these answers, however, engineering solutions can undoubtedly be found.
And so the good doctor did pose some questions and offer some answers on a very vital concern, urban development.
John, next, I have a question.
For me?
Perhaps. Certainly it was of high interest to all those IEEE convention members who attended a symposium on the subject, "Where is the Electrical Engineering Profession Headed?" Panelist S.W. Herwald, Jr., past president of the IEEE, gave this answer.
When you ask me what direction is electrical engineering going in, I think my prime answer would be it's going in the direction of where the problems requiring the application of technology for economic solution are going. So I think engineers have as diverse views as to where the general society ought to go as any other group of people.
Mr. Herwald, who is now a vice president of Westinghouse Electric, spoke of industry problems he had encountered and then came to the subject of a growing need for recycling, for making greater reuse of existing materials.
Take mining. Someplace we're going to have to start accounting for the byproducts of what comes out of the mining as well as your mining. What about the tin cans that we're piling up that are supposedly disposable but aren't really disposable? And I think we've got a recycling problem on water. I think we've got a recycling problem on pollution. I think we've got a recycling problem on many things that we're going to have to start thinking about using over and over and over again.
The next panelist, Mr. J.L. McLucas, president of the MITRE Corporation, envisioned the future as a challenge for the young, upcoming engineer.
Seems to me that the engineering student and the engineering practitioner, or the scientist, is caught up in he's in a bind right now because he's being pulled in many different directions. If you're a student and you want to be an engineer, then they tell you that you must take all these courses in basic sciences because engineering is now merging with science. And you must take courses in economics because you must be concerned with whether or not we can afford some of your vast ideas. And more recently, we have to be more conversant with some of the social effects of our vast engineering projects. What I'm leading to is that there is a responsibility both on the part of the practicing engineer and the incipient engineer to broaden his fields of interest to the point where he can cope with not only the subject matter that he thought he was becoming involved in, but the effects on the society as a whole.
Professor W.K. Linville of Stanford University sounded his agreement.
The problem now is one of combining sociological issues and technological issues. And this requires a level of exploration of the issues that's now sort of the big brother, the broad scope extension of what we've seen going on already with automation. Our society, I think, now has to find ways of cycling through exploratory processes.
As the discussion progressed, Mr. McLucas rose again to contrast the past and the future.
There was a time when the engineer could think of his role as being constructive. In other words, there were specific engineering jobs that needed to be done, and he operated more or less in a fixed environment. If you were building a bridge across a river, this did not affect the world. It just affected your ability to cross the river. But as we go further and further in creating vast engineering projects, we do gradually affect the environment. And in fact, the process of generation of power at the moment is changing the balance of CO2 in the atmosphere at a significant rate, so that if you extrapolate that current rate for 100 years, it really could have an effect on life on the planet.
The final panelist, Dr. T.F. Rogers, is a director of research with the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. Speaking of those engineers and technicians pursuing the responsibilities of urban development, Dr. Rogers had this to say, and it was not all optimistic.
Initially, they will learn to their chagrin, dismay, that the market is extraordinarily fragmented. There is no Pentagon or Maryland Avenue Southwest for research, development, and production on the urban scene. There are relatively few funds available at either the federal or the local level for research and development. There are relatively few professionals dealing with such matters at the state and local level. And the federal role in support of R&D in some of these areas is not yet clear at all, in marked contrast, I would say, to the defense and the space areas. And they will learn that it is very difficult and expensive to conduct large-scale development tests and engineering and system evaluation.
Dr. Rogers emphasized that there exist extreme variations in codes and standards in different localities across the country, and added,
there is a lack of hard intelligence on local needs, on local desires, on local capacities, and local commitments.
An appropriate closing remark for this discussion on where the electrical engineering profession is headed was provided by Dr. Rogers when he said,
where the scientists and the engineers are going, where are they heading on the urban scene, in my judgment, to a very great extent, depends upon them, upon us. But not initially as scientists and as engineers, but rather primarily as citizens, as taxpayers, and as local residents.
Perhaps the most publicized session of the IEEE convention held at the New York Hilton was the panel discussion entitled Electronically Expanding the Citizen's World. Mr. Walter R. Beam, chairman of the Institute's Technical Program Committee, described the subject matter in these words.
How we are expanding the citizens' opportunities for education, entertainment, and a better life through electronics.
First to speak was Dr. E.G. Fabini, vice president of IBM.
And my purpose today is to talk to you about the effect computers will have on our lives. A major technology has three stages. In the first stage, you do what you used to do before, only you do it better. In the second stage, you do new things that you never did before, and of course, you do them better because you couldn't do them beforehand. But the third stage, and this is the important one, is when you change your lives to match the new capability that the technology gives you.
Dr. Fabini declared that the impact of stages 1 and 2 have been felt, but that stage 3 is something we have not yet come to realize. Referring to the endless speculation as to the world of the future, Fabini scoffed at some of the predictions, such as the idea that cash and checks would no longer be employed. Also that the computer would make the school teacher obsolete and unnecessary.
Along these lines, Dr. Fabini commented that technology forecasting has become a form of entertainment. One could scarcely open a newspaper without finding predictions.
However, the speaker did do a little predicting of his own in a conservative fashion and finished his talk with these words.
We are going to see the computers penetrate our lives just like television, or the internal combustion engine, or the jet aircraft. We have not yet solved all the problems that stand in the way of this achievement, but the solution is both possible and near. We are going to see the electronic data handling devices appear in forms that are neither obvious nor expected today. As a matter of fact, we see some of the devices which are expected not, in fact, come true. We can predict some, deny others, but we can be sure that with devices that can help human beings stretch their thought processes, There is no doubt that we will see computers force us to modify our lives and have a deep impact on it.
The next panelist, Dr. K.G. McKay, Vice President of Engineering at AT&T, spoke somewhat whimsically.
Tonight we're indulging in futurology, and this activity puts a communications engineer in somewhat of a peculiar position, because in a sense, virtually everything we have thought of on these lines can be done.
Having thus stimulated the audience, Dr. McKay continued,
and the real question is, what probably will be done? And this isn't just a technical problem. It hinges rather heavily on a blend of technology and economics and human desire. For example, it's now technically possible for NASA to put every person in New York City into orbit around the moon. And I suggest that both economics and human desire negate this achievement, at least for the near future.
Of the very foreseeable future, Dr. McKay had this to say.
Now, plans are currently underway, which, if they come to fruition, will provide for a major increase in the use of mobile telephones. This is in automobiles and private boats, as well as on commercial aircraft and on trains. And this hinges upon the effective exploitation of the frequencies above 900 megahertz.
Dr. McKay also predicted that a household market for computers would develop, and that assembled computers could be used in the home for a variety of services, including weather reports, ski information, even the preparation of one's income tax.
My problem isn't preparation, it's paying the tax.
That's so right. The next panelist was Mr. James Hillier, Executive Vice President of RCA, who made this interesting observation.
The basic purpose of most electronic systems is to provide a service in which the largest ingredient is information. This is true whether we are discussing television or the navigation of a jet plane by satellite.
According to Mr. Hillier, technology owes something to the past.
The services we now provide electronically to the consumer at home were not completely new when they were introduced. They were all convenient extensions and improvements of services already available and being used. The messenger, the mails, the telegraph preceded the telephone. The lecture hall, music, or concert hall, the theater, and the movies all preceded the radio and television complex. I believe we should think more in the terms of new services rather than new boxes. I believe that the new services will be extensions of existing services, that the electronic versions will be more current, more immediate, more convenient, lower cost ultimately, and available to more people.
Mr. Hillier spoke of a current innovation, the video record, and predicted multiple uses for it, both in education and entertainment.
The video record will give the consumer the opportunity to select more precisely the program he wants and give him complete flexibility as to the timing of his viewing. It's obvious from my brief remarks that I believe there are many opportunities to expand the citizen's world by electronics. They are not exclusively technical challenges, but they will require substantial entrepreneurial skills and very creative ones.
The final speaker on the subject of expanding the citizen's world took a less rosy view than those who had preceded him. In fact, he was sharply critical of man's so-called progress. J. H. Holloman, a former president of the University of Oklahoma, insisted that too many of us refuse to face facts. He holds that the world is changing from a concept of I to a concept of us, and that the ramifications, unless we understand them and do something about them, threaten the very technology we have already built.
This generation that's going to college is really the first television generation. It is the first group of youngsters who lived in an all-at-once world. A world when they get up in the morning, turn on the television set, the radio, and read the newspaper simultaneously, and listen to their mother say, "Eat your breakfast." This is a world in which you don't just concern yourself about I, you concern yourself about them. This is an usness world. It is a world of community, and in fact, there is very little sense of community.
Dr. Holloman seemed to place the blame on the scientific doorstep, said he.
Your technology has made it almost impossible for a man to be himself. We have used the devices of communication via telephone and the computer to attempt to centralize, because it appears to be more efficient to do so when everything around you says, "We must decentralize." And therefore, one of the aspects of the future of electronics must be that it provides an intimacy between people in small groups and not remove people the one from the other.
Dr. Holloman's acid criticism brought the session to a close on a controversial note. The entire convention had been a live-wire affair, with opinions freely expressed by both speakers and audience alike.
Time now for a change of pace with the five-minute feature, Direct Contact, a brief but informative encounter with today's engineer in one of the specialized fields he inhabits.
The place, San Francisco. The reporter, Jim Harriet. And today's engineer, Mr. Arthur Rock, chairman of the Board of Scientific Data. Mr. Rock is a unique personality, a scientist and also a banker, having his own banking firm of Arthur Rock and Company.
Because the subject of budgets and financial restraints as applied by management to a technically oriented company is of such general interest, I am here, Mr. Rock, to ask a few questions. Would you, for instance, give us your recommendation on necessary controls for a new business?
The only way I know to control a new business is by measuring progress against a budget.
But how do you know if a budget is relative?
Well, that all gets back to my philosophy of having experienced people. People who have had profit and loss responsibility draw up the budgets.
What about pitfalls to be avoided?
We prefer to have the people we back learn where the pitfalls are on someone else's time and someone else's money and have proven themselves. You cannot assure yourself of success using this method, but at least you can have some confidence that the budgets are somewhat realistic.
I have no figures on failures, but the percentage in new businesses is said to be high. Where would you place the blame for such failures?
I think more new companies fail because they underprice their products than any other reason. There seems to be a willingness to build products against what the competition is building them for, against what people think is a reasonable profit margin.
What disciplines, if any, are imposed by management upon themselves?
Mature companies in mature industries generally can finance themselves through depreciation, retained earnings, and debt. For instance, in looking over the records, I can find no record whatsoever of U.S. Steel having ever sold any equity securities. Thus, the external discipline of the stock market's evaluation of these companies is not imposed on management's judgment. The only discipline they have is internal, the allocation of funds available to the projects presented, which usually does not cut out any of the demands for funds.
I believe you've expressed the opinion that conglomerates may be a necessity in today's environment. Would you comment?
Conglomerates are continually trying to balance the source and application of funds. They are taking funds from their subsidiaries in mature industries that do not get a high return on invested capital and redeploying those funds to the subsidiaries in the new technologies where the return on invested capital is much higher. Thus, a new discipline is imposed, and one that I think is extremely important in order to best use the available resources.
Thank you very much, Mr. Arthur Rock, for being our guest on today's feature interview, Direct Contact. Now back to John Wolfe in New York with more items of interest.
Thanks, Jim. Next.
News of the industry.
From Washington, D.C., where the lawmakers gather.
Michigan Congressman John Dingell has introduced a bill which would shake up the manner in which industries go about setting voluntary standards. The bill would require that before a voluntary industrial standard could be established, it would have to be approved by the Secretary of Commerce, the National Board of Standards, and the Federal Trade Commission.
Congressman Dingell's bill is very specific in its definition of standards. It reads, and we quote, "Formal stipulations as to the qualities of processes, products, commodities with respect to their purity, performance, or other objective characteristics, and specifications of the means of measurement for other observations to determine the extent to which a process, product, or commodity conforms to the standard." End of quote.
According to Congressman Dingell, this bill will give the appropriate federal agencies adequate authority to assure the establishment of standards which are fair to consumers and fair to all segments of the immediate industry, as well as related industries.
Another area in which more legislation might be expected from this Congress concerns radiation. As you remember, Jim, before the last Congress ended, it passed the Radiation Control Act of 1968.
What's happened since, John?
Not very much, Jim. but there is considerable agitation from some congressmen to see action taken to implement the bill and make it effective in many areas of operation.
As regards color television sets, based on the findings of a survey in Suffolk County, New York, some congressmen have asked for the recall of color sets.
It should be pointed out that set manufacturers have made extensive efforts to keep radiation within safe limits, and the industry has established far-reaching programs of training service technicians to avoid voltage settings above the prescribed level.
Right, John. And radiation from other electronic equipment is also being watched closely by the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. HEW announced recently that it will survey electronic equipment in high school science classes for signs of unsafe radiation. Type of equipment that will get special attention are X-ray units, handheld fluoroscopes, Van de Graaff accelerators, and microwave and laser devices.
Thanks, Jim. That sums up news of the industry for this edition.
And brings this program of dialogue and information to the point where we look in our crystal ball and predict upcoming events.
Events, you might add, Jim, of special interest to the members of IEEE. So now is the time to mark your calendars and make plans to attend. June 9th and 10th, the Chicago Spring Conference on Broadcast and TV Receivers, to be held at the Marriott Motor Hotel, Des Plaines, Illinois, and sponsored by the GBTR Chicago Section.
June 9th through 11th, the International Communications Conference at the University of Boulder, Colorado, sponsored by G-Comtech, Denver Section.
June 17th through 19th, the Electromagnetic Compatibility Symposium, sponsored by GEMC.
It's being held in Asbury Park, New Jersey, isn't it, John?
Yes, Jim, at the Berkeley Carteret Hotel. While at the Leamington Hotel in Minneapolis, Minnesota, these same 2 days, June 17th through 19th, the GC will be holding the Computer Conference.
June 22nd through 27th, the Summer Power Meeting, sponsored by GP, meets at the Sheraton Dallas Hotel, Dallas, Texas.
And moving ahead to July, July 7th through the 11th are the dates to mark down for the Conference on Nuclear and Space Radiation Effects, to be held at the Penn State University under the sponsorship of GNS, NASA, DASA, AEC, and Penn State University itself.
Some fascinating subject and important engineering events that are to be remembered.
To be remembered, too, is that the program you have been hearing is a pilot of a proposed monthly series available to all members of the IEEE on a subscription basis. Plan now to become a regular subscriber to these monthly programs of dialogue and information. Data, devices, and designs. The three Ds, voice of the three Es.
And now it's goodbye from Jim Harriet.
And from John Wolfe, speaking for the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers.